Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in English with a concentration in literature studies and an MFA in creative writing. strose.edu/gradprograms.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In 2008, Brian Selznick's groundbreaking book, The Invention of Hugo Cabret, was awarded the Caldecott Medal. It was nominated for a National Book Award and was the basis for Martin Scorsese's Oscar-winning film, Hugo. His follow-up illustrated novel, Wonderstruck, debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. His newest illustrated novel is The Marvels, where two seemingly unrelated stories, one in words, the other in pictures, come together. The illustrated story begins in 1766 with Billy Marvel, the lone survivor of a shipwreck, and charts the adventures of his family of actors over five generations. The prose story opens in 1990 and follows Joseph, who has run away from school to an estranged uncle's puzzling house in London, where he, along with the reader, must piece together many mysteries. It is a great pleasure to welcome Brian Selznick to The Book Show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here with you.
Very nice to have you on the program. When you took on this particular project of The Marvels, how did it differ from the other two books? Because there definitely seems to be an evolution.
Yeah. With each of the books, I try to figure out how to use illustrations and text in a way that I haven't quite done before. So with Hugo, I was sort of taking everything I had learned over the 15 years of having made books before I made Hugo and ended up telling, you know, a single story with words and pictures that go back and forth throughout the entire book. And then Wonderstruck, I separated the words from the pictures into two different stories, but they still weave back and forth. So it goes back from the word story in Wonderstruck that's set in the 1970s, and it cuts back and forth with a picture story that's set in the 20s. For The Marvels, I didn't want to repeat myself with either of those structures. And so because of what the story turned out to be, I ended up, like Wonderstruck, having two different stories, but as you said, having one story just with pictures, and they're all together. So the book actually opens with 400 pages of this illustrated story. And so it leads up to the cliffhanger in 1900 and then cuts very suddenly to the next 200 pages, which are all text. So it has certain overlaps with Wonderstruck, but it was trying to figure out what I could do with the words and the pictures in a way that was different than the other two, but then also, as I need to do with each of the books, is find the reason that the pictures have to be the structure that they're in for this particular story. So because of how the story unfolded, the 400 pages of pictures first, and then the 200 pages of a different story second ended up working out pretty well.
Does that come from an outlining process of this is how I'm going to tell the story? This is the beginning, this is the middle, this is the end.
Everything starts, it always feels very random when it starts. There's generally a very small moment of inspiration that is a very small, tiny detail. You know, with Hugo, I had read that Georges Méliès, the filmmaker, had a collection of automatons that were destroyed and thrown away at the end of his life, and I just pictured a kid finding one of those broken machines and fixing it. And that was all I had. And so the 3 years of making Hugo was finding out who that kid was and the relationship to the automatons and why the automaton was destroyed. And Wonderstruck was very much about some deaf people who I had met and become friends with and learning about the deaf community. And with The Marvels, I had really fallen in love with this, with a real version of this strange, mysterious house that's in London. It's sort of like a museum called the Dennis Evers House. And I had always been interested in the theater. I generally start with handwritten notes in a notebook before I transfer everything to my computer. And so it does start with a kind of outline, but like a really, really general outline. And sometimes I'll, you know, like there is a kid You know, he lives in Paris. He is in a train station, and sometimes that's all I'll have for a while. And then it's sort of collecting other ideas, other things that interest me, trying to think about who these characters might be, and then connecting the other places that I'm trying to put into the book. I will often have places and sort of these specific events that I know I want in the book, but I don't know where they'll work in the book. So a lot of the plot is just figuring out how to get them into the story. And so retroactively, when I finish the book after 3 years of working on it, it should feel like it's the emotional drive of the main character who's carrying us through the story, but I've actually built the entire thing backwards from that with plot and plot points and then few ideas about the character. But I guess to answer your question, yes, everything starts off as an outline and then sort of grows from there.
The fascination that I've always had with your work is that it is displayed and presented in the way that it is in a traditional book form. Mm-hmm. So in 600 pages or more, you will have this beautiful art, which often gets sort of gobbled up in the spine. And I've always wondered if that bothers you, or is that part of the allure?
That place where drawings are gobbled in the spine is called the gutter, which, you know, sounds as frustrating and dark as it is to illustrators. It's sort of the bane, I believe, of all illustrators' existence, especially for a book, these books like mine, where I'm doing the full page bleeds, and the drawing goes across both pages of the spread when you open the book. You always have to deal with the gutter. So every drawing that I have done for Hugo, Wonderstruck, and the Marvels, and every book I did before those, takes into account the center of the picture, the gutter. So if you go back, and hopefully if I've done my job right, there's never any important information that's lost in the center of the gutter because I've kept it away. You know, there's a lot of times I want to have like a beautiful close-up of a face centered right in the drawing, but you can't center a face in a full-page spread drawing. Well, or at least it's really hard to do. It can be done, but it's really hard to do because you end up with a line going right down the center of the nose. You don't want to have an eye in the gutter. You don't want to have someone's hand reaching into the gutter. You know, there are people who have used the gutter as design elements where things come in and out of the gutter. There's ways to incorporate it, but generally it's mostly about avoiding the gutter. And when I was doing Hugo, I was aware that all the drawings were going to be double page spreads, and I wanted the reader to feel like they were losing as little information as they could. So I actually went out and went to bookstores and bought as many books as I could that opened as flat as possible, where the gutter was the least problematic. It turned out a lot of cookbooks have what's called a loose Smith-sewn binding so that they can open flat and sit on the counter while you're cooking. So I brought in all these cookbooks and all these other kinds of books to my publisher, Scholastic, and we've published all of these books with that type of binding so it opens as flat as possible.
You were talking about the close-up, which I find fascinating because you will have a character, you will put them into a context, and then the next page will be the close-up. Is that done in a linear fashion?
When I'm actually drawing them?
Yes.
Yes, yeah. So I think pretty cinematically so that when I'm seeing in my mind how a narrative should unfold, I'm seeing it somewhat like a movie camera might see it. So a lot of what I'm doing as I'm doing my drawings is related probably to storyboards that you might make when you're directing a movie. And so I'm drawing all of these storyboards, and I know that if I'm going to have a moment with a character that's very intimate or very important and I want to zoom in on that character, I will, you know, I'll do my little rough sketches first and then work it in. But then I will always do the further shot first. And then sometimes I'll even like blow it up on a Xerox machine and trace it as close as possible for the, and then completely redo it, but then so that the close up matches as much as possible. So that, but they are always done in order. In fact, the entire book is done in order. I start after doing all of my research and all my rough sketches. I start on the first drawing on, you know, the first day of working on the final art and go straight through to the last drawing.
And how was the art done?
They're little. They're little. They're done 1/4 size of the drawings that you see in the book. So that they get blown up. That means they're about 3 by 5 inches. And they, you know, they're done under a magnifying glass with a very sharp pencil. And I do that for a couple of reasons. I mean, I started doing it with Hugo because that's about the size that a real automaton that I saw drew pictures. And it's somewhat faster to draw a smaller picture because you have less paper to cover. But also, by drawing small and blowing it up, it magnifies every one of the individual lines that I've done. So I work in a style called cross-hatching, where it's just all the little lines are crossed back and forth till it builds up and feels hopefully somewhat three-dimensional and atmospheric. All of the little lines, by blowing them up, they get a little bit of air between them. You get to see a little bit more of the graphite itself. And I'm very interested in sort of magnifying the hand-done quality of the work themselves. I like the reader to be reminded on some level, if not a conscious level, but some level, that these are all very, very hand-done drawings. So it takes about it took me about a year to do the finished art in the Marvels after about 2 years of research and sketches.
In that research and sketches, what do you learn in that process?
Well, I learn everything, because half the time when I'm starting the research, I don't actually have the story finished yet. And so very often it's by doing the research that I discover a moment in the in what I think can be the narrative that will bring my story together. So sometimes I actually discover the plot. I discover details about the characters. And then, you know, on a very basic level, I can draw a little bit from my head. Like, I'm not one of those people who can, like, if you told me to draw a bicycle right now, I would not do it because it would be embarrassing. But if I go out and I find a bicycle that I like and I photograph the bicycle and I go home and I have a lot of time by myself with the photograph of the bicycle and my memory of having been on a bicycle, because you also want to, drawings aren't just about what they look like. It's also very much what they feel like and the experience of, you know, I am thinking about the experience of being inside the drawing as well. But in terms of what it looks like, I really need the time and the detail of the research and the photographs to make it look the way I want the pictures to look. You know, and then I'll photograph models and I'll put them in sometimes in some costume pieces, but that'll help me see how fabric folds and light falls on the face, and some of which I could kind of imagine, but it's the things I learned by looking that at the actual object and sometimes at photographs that really helps. And then by traveling to the places where the books are set, I'm able to experience being in that place so that I can then take that feeling and try to put it into the drawing. Because as hard as I work to make things look accurate, the thing that I think is trickier and more important is trying to get how something feels into the picture. So all of that comes from the research.
Which I find really interesting because of, you mentioned this example, but the theater. Mm. I mean, we're in that theater.
Uh-huh.
You can feel the seats. You can smell the seats.
Oh, good.
You can see that stage. And it's beautiful and yet a little shabby. And so you mentioned a moment ago being in that, being in the picture, but you also want us really to be in that seat, in that, mm-hmm. on that ship.
Right.
In that apartment.
Right, right. And, you know, obviously I wasn't in a shipwreck. I wasn't on a ship. But for something like that, I'm able to do as much research as I can about, you know, other people who have painted and envisioned shipwrecks. I looked a lot at Gustave Doré, who's one of my favorite 19th century artists. And he did an amazing book of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And there's some incredible shots of the ship and the sea and storms in that. And I drew a lot of the imagery from that. But then something like the theater, the Royal Haymarket, is a real theater in London that was built in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And when I was in London researching, I lived right up the street. And so I became friends with the daughter of the owner of the theater, and I had full access to the theater whenever I wanted. So I was in those seats and in backstage and on the scenery and around the scenery, and it was an amazing experience. So that is very much what I tried to put into the pictures.
Brian Selznick is our guest on this week's book show. His new illustrated novel is The Marvels. It is published by Scholastic. Let's talk about the story here, because it does have similarities with your other stories of a child and trying to find that place and the belonging.
That idea kind of grew somewhat accidentally out of the narrative for The Invention of Hugo Cabret. And when I was making the book, I very much wanted to write a book about a kid who meets Georges Méliès and lives in this French train station and ends up safe in a new home at the end. You know, one of my readers told me after they had finished the book that they loved that this book was about how we make our own families. And that wasn't something I had consciously thought of when I was making the book. I didn't realize that's what my book was about. But as soon as they said that to me, I realized that they were right. And that is actually what my book was about. And that was very much what Wonderstruck became about. So when I was working on The Marvels, I wanted to take that theme and see how far I could go with it. You know, so it definitely is part of why I think of these three books as a kind of trilogy, even though there's no characters that overlap or real, you know, specific plot points, but they all are connected by this idea that, you know, we go out and we make our own families and we surround ourselves with people who we love. And that's very much what The Marvels is about.
Did you feel like the outsider as a child that so many of the children in these books feel like?
You know, I think probably in some fashion, all children feel like outsiders at some point. And I grew up in suburban New Jersey. I had a very, very happy upbringing. You know, but I was a gay kid and it was the 70s and, you know, it was a total secret. And so, you know, I don't know. It's this interesting thing where I think this is true of a lot of gay people who don't come out till later in their lives. You develop this interesting kind of it's not quite a double life, but a way of seeing the world in two different ways. You know, you've got the world as it seems like everybody is seeing it. And then you've got this other point of view that sees things in a different way because you have this thing that you're not talking about and it will affect you. And so I think that idea, of course, became a very profound part of who I am and it definitely colors the work that I do. But, you know, when I was doing Wonderstruck and I was doing research and learning about deaf culture and learning about deaf kids who grew up in families with hearing parents, I realized like there were so many parallels with what I had experienced when I was younger. And, you know, it's just interesting because I feel like everybody at some point has something that they don't tell anybody else. You know, like we all have something that we consider a secret. And so many of us as kids identify as the outsider. And there's not any one specific thing that makes you an outsider. It's just, I think, how so many of us come to identify ourselves. And I think that's why there's so many outsiders in children's literature is because it's who we relate to.
You mentioned a moment ago that you wanted to, in this book, take what you did in the first two and then take it as far as you could go. That is not only in the time span, which goes into the 1700s to today, but also to what you were just talking about and to a much deeper emotional level as well.
Yeah, this was a really hard book to make. I mean, they're all really hard. Like when I made Hugo, I really had never made a book like that before. I didn't know if anybody would like it. It was a book about French silent movies, not really a popular topic for children's books. It was told in this weird way with words and pictures. I didn't know if anybody would be able to follow the narrative. It wasn't until the book came out that I, you know, started meeting kids and it became clear very quickly that they got not just the structure of the book, and it was very easy to read the narrative with the words and the pictures the way I had designed it, but that they were responding to the character and the story in a very profound way as well. And, you know, and then there was, you know, more in terms of the relationships and friendships and family that came out in Wonderstruck. And so, yes, in The Marvels, I think also because there's a lot of very serious themes in the book. There are other serious issues that the characters are dealing with. There's important ideas around grief that run throughout the book, and how we grieve and why we grieve and what we leave behind. And, you know, I definitely was thinking about the times in my life when I've grieved the hardest. And my dad died right before I started working on Hugo. And, you know, so when I was writing Hugo, like, I really didn't want to kill Hugo's dad. Like, I really tried to keep Hugo's dad alive. But then I eventually realized that Hugo's dad needed to die. And, you know, and it be, for anyone who hasn't read Hugo, spoiler alert, his dad does die. And I, you know, I felt like, you know, that's where the story needed to go. And that's what needed to happen. And, you know, I was at my dad's deathbed. I was friends with Maurice Sendak, and he was very influential in my life and very important. And, you know, I was at his deathbed, and that sense of being with someone when they're moving from this world to wherever else you think someone is going, you know, it's a very profound thing. And so that's, you know, there's a lot of funny parts, and it's an adventure, and it's a mystery, but there's also, you know, these serious elements about, you know, the people who we love in our lives and what happens when we lose them. And, you know, but kids, you know, we all experience loss and we all experience sadness. And that's something I think that kids really understand. And so I just tried to present it in a way that felt honest and, you know, but it is very much coming from the things that I've experienced directly in my life.
I've heard you talk about and explain the relationship that you had with Maurice Sendak, and especially with his work and Where the Wild Things Are, learning the power of not only the pictures but also the words.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if you want to learn how to illustrate children's books, you could go to school, you could study children's books, you could, you know, have all sorts of classes, or you could read Where the Wild Things Are. Because I feel like everything you need to know about what a book can be is in those 32 pages. And so I've spent a lot of time reading and rereading and being inside the world of Where the Wild Things Are, as so many of us have. Of course, sure. It's a classic, and we all love it, and we all feel like any great work of art, we all feel like it's ours. You know, it's like, oh, it's so nice that Maurice Sendak made that book for me. And it's very much how I feel. But I also know that's how we all feel about it. But, you know, when I first started looking at it, when I myself wanted to be an illustrator and realized that the first drawing is really small and it's in this big sea of white space and there's, you know, a line of text. And then as you turn the pages, the drawings get bigger and bigger until you get to the wild rumpus where there's no more white space, there's no more text, and the pictures become full page bleeds with the gutter down the center, and you move through the wild rumpus at your own pace as the reader, you're in control. And then when he gets back home, the room that had started off small in the beginning of the book now takes up half the book, and so his physical real world has changed from the adventures he's just been through. And then, of course, the famous last line, "and it was still hot," appears on a page when you turn the page after seeing his room, and the line appears by itself on a white page. There's no pictures. All that he gives us are the words, "and it was still hot." And we don't need pictures at that point. We've moved beyond the pictures, because those five words, you know, that's Max's mother saying, "I love you." Like, that's how we understand what love is. And, you know, looking at the structure of what that book is doing, the story itself, the character, the turning of the pages, so the using the technology of the book. People always think it's either a technology like tablets or computers or a book, but books are a technology. They were a revolutionary technology. They're a limited technology. All they do is open, and then they have page turns. But within that, you can do anything. And so I feel like everything that I've done in all of my books grows out of something that I learned in Where the Wild Things Are. And so you can go back and look at The Invention of Hugo Cabret, where there's all the picture sequences, and read them as the outgrowth of the Wild Rumpus from Maurice's book. And so when I met him, I got all tongue-tied and I just couldn't say anything. And so I asked his assistant for his address so that I could write everything down and say everything that I wanted to say. So I was able to express all of that to him.
Brian Selznick's new book is The Marvels, published by Scholastic. Brian, what a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Thanks also to Paul Ruest and Argo Studios. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.